Hi, this is Bill Lindeke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in Minnesota. The podcast this week is the audio from the special Streets.mn panel at the recent Railvolution conference that took place in downtown Minneapolis this September. Earlier this year, some of the conference organizers approached the Streets.mn board about setting up a panel session that would feature a bunch of our writers debating key issues from the Streets.mn archives. Railvolution, you should know, is a big national transit-oriented development conference where people who work on those kinds of issues from all over the country come and get together and meet once a year. And this year it was held in downtown Minneapolis. And so we did it. We put together this panel of bloggers. I think it was called The Bloggers Speak or something like that. I don't remember the exact title, but it was really successful. We had a room packed with planners, engineers, and officials from all over the country to hear six of our writers debate the pros and cons of three often controversial topics. They were urban streetcars, light rail, and equity, so specifically about whether the transit plan put in place by the Met Council to build things like the Botno and the Southwest Light Rail do anything for equity and inequality in the Twin Cities. And then the third topic was the downtown skyway system. I was one of the speakers arguing the pro-streetcar position, and I was joined by Nick Magrino, Cameron Conway, Alex Cicchini, Jana Flissrand, and Sam Newberg, all of whom debated different topics in turn. It was a lot of fun. We had a lot of feedback from the audience. People really seemed to like it. Everybody clapped and said nice things about it afterwards. So I think you'll enjoy the conversation, and I taped it. But I didn't tape it very well. It was hard to put the microphone anywhere near the speaker, so it's not the best quality audio. Anyway, I think you'll enjoy it regardless, because it certainly was a spirited debate and a real fun time for everybody involved. Before I play the tape, though, please consider helping out with our Streets.mn fundraising campaign for better podcast equipment. For example, the microphone that I'm listening, that I'm speaking into right now, or the one that I used for this session recording. If you've been listening to previous podcasts, including this one, you're probably aware that audio quality could be improved, and I could really use your help, and Streets.mn could really use your help to purchase a few more things that might make these podcasts a bit easier to listen to, and coincidentally help pay for our website. So, yeah, would you help out? That'd be great. If you can spare a few dollars, $10, $20, $50, whatever, chip in and help out with the costs. We really appreciate it. You can do it by becoming a member of Streets.mn on our website's front page. You get some other benefits for doing that too. So I think it's a good deal, and it means a lot to everybody who's been putting this website together. So that said, thanks for listening. Enjoy this quite lengthy panel session from the Railvolution Conference.
This is, I am told, the first ever debate at Railvolution. Yes. Jeff says number one.
Yes.
All right, it's going to be fantastic, and we're going to need your help to make that happen. I'll tell you how in a minute. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming. We're running until 3:30. Part of that is going to be question and answer. So Kathy, who I'll tell you more about in a second, is going to hand out some colorful cards between now.
I did it, kind of already.
You have some colorful cards.
Yeah.
I guarantee that at least some of you will have some questions. You're going to write your questions down on those cards, and I'll be walking around game show host style, and you'll hand them to me, and that way we don't get the long question that isn't quite a question. You know what I mean? So make your question very pointed, because that's what this is about. We're not just agreeing with each other. We're trying to create a little honest discussion, and the fewer words it is, the more likely I am to read it out loud, okay? So welcome again. Thank you to the panelists. Well, I will introduce to you as we go. And special thanks and notes to Kathy Albert from Sound Transit and Jeff Wood from The Overhead Wire for this idea and for their efforts to bring this session into being. We had many, many phone calls, many, many emails, and I give them full credit for what I hope you are about to enjoy. And of course, the idea is to keep Railvolution not just relevant to the work that we all do, but also lively and engaging. That's why we're talking this fast, at least I am. So here's what we're gonna do, and here are the rules. We're gonna have three debates, okay? Each of them is gonna be about 25 minutes long. And according to my math, as checked by my kids, that will leave us time at the end for some audience questions and answers. So here go the rules. It's just like in high school, I bet you remember. The first presenter, as chosen ahead of time, will have 5 minutes. That presenter will stand here and maybe show you some images, mostly as background, not to make the point. This will not be one of those boring PowerPoint shows. It's all about conveying arguments verbally, okay? Then presenter two, the other person on a specific topic, more on the topics in a minute, will stand here for 5 minutes. Presenter one will have 2 minutes for a rebuttal. Presenter two will have 2 minutes for a re-rebuttal and to ask a question for a minute. And then presenter one will answer that question for a minute and pose a question back to presenter two, who will answer it for 1 minute. When you add all that up, you're at about 25 minutes. You do that three times. I'm not taking too long right now. There'll be time at the end, 7 to 10 minutes, for audience questions. And you're gonna write really long questions. You're gonna write really short questions so we can fit in as many as possible, right? Our three topics today, in this order, streetcars, regional transit planning, and skyways, okay? These are excellent topics. Our panelists care about them passionately, as many of us do, and we're all eager to hear what they have to say. So, everybody's good on the rules, right? Good. And you're gonna write really short questions, right? Right. Okay, and by the way, we're gonna keep our panelists on time with these handy cards, and you're all gonna help me. The first card comes at 2 minutes, and I didn't do it in the right order, so the green one is 30 seconds, and then the red one says time, and that means stop, right? So if they keep going past that, they're not going to keep going past that. They assure me they won't. Our first topic is streetcars. Are they a good idea, and will they happen? Okay? And who's talking about streetcars?
Us two.
Oh, right. Right. And let's see. Who should I introduce first? Nick? Yes. Nick Magrino. What's that?
Oh,
I can. Are you going to go first?
Yeah, we can do it.
All right, fine. Nick Magrino. Nick walked to RailVolution this morning from his apartment in nearby Loring Park. He's a writer and board member at streets.mn, and his commute involves a bus that moves at walking speed. And who's doing the other side of streetcars again? Yes, Bill Lindeke. Bill's been blogging about sidewalks in cities since 2005, ever since he read Jane Jacobs. He's a PhD candidate in geography at the University of Minnesota, working on his dissertation about bicycling, cities, and affect. Somebody come on up here. 5 minutes. Go. Including the walk.
there's a picture somewhere here. You hit down.
Escape.
Okay. In case anybody doesn't know about the streetcar proposals in Minneapolis and St. Paul, this is just a map of the two proposals that are currently in the works. Both Minneapolis and St. Paul have independently come up with plans, so the details are somewhat important to the debate, and the debate is basically about these proposals. Each one identified a starter line, Nicollet and Central in Minneapolis, so it would go right past this hotel in theory, and in St. Paul at 7th Street, East and West 7th Street, both of them through downtown, and in both cases the funding is a little bit unclear at this point. But anyway, I wanted to thank everybody because a lot of the arguments I'm going to make are coming from the streets.mn website, and all of us write for it. And so if you ever want to read more about these sorts of interesting debates, just check our website out. It's a relatively new thing. It's been growing really quickly. So that's a plug. When you talk about streetcars, a lot of people talk about this concept called rail bias. That's where I'm going to start with my argument. People say, well, people have a rail bias, and they just like streetcars for some reason, and we don't know why, and it's kind of mystical, it's almost like a totemic thing, you know. But I want to say the rail bias is not so hard to understand. There are lots of reasons why streetcars are actually better, and they're measurable, and they're legitimate. They're not like this ineffable quality. You can hold more people in them. They run on electricity, okay, which means that they're quiet. They don't make a lot of noise. These things you can all measure and notice, and they make the experience much better. The ride is smoother than a bus. We're kind of contrasting them to buses right now. And the accessibility factor is really important. So the streetcar comes right up to the platform, and you can roll right on and right out if you're in a wheelchair, if you're older, or whatever. So there's lots of sort of qualitative but significant and measurable things about streetcars that are good. And that explains why the rail bias exists. I want to say it's not a bias. It's just common sense. And this all kind of comes back to how we measure and think about how people make decisions, how people make transportation decisions. Often, we'll model behavior as sort of a combination, X, Y plus Z sort of thing about price, distance, and time, right? And you can kind of measure everything that way and say, well, that's what transportation should be. You come up with the best and most efficient way to solve that equation. And that's really simple if you think about it in a car perspective, because in cars, when you're planning for cars, you can sort of cut off what's happening inside the car. You don't really care what music people are listening to or how they affect their climate control inside the car. You can just look at the car as an autonomous discrete object and ask how much does it cost, how long does it take, and what's the distance that we're covering, and say, well, that's a good transportation system. That's all not true when you're talking about transit or walking or biking, what I study. Price is not so rational, right? People obsess about the price of gas or the price of parking, but when it comes to something that is vague, like insurance tax rates or whatever, they sort of disappear. The actual distance that you travel is very malleable, right? So you might think you walked a mile, but actually it was 2 miles because it's a very pleasant walk, or vice versa if it's a really horrible walk. The amount of time you're spending, a 45-minute ride to St. Paul might be really pleasant if you're looking out the window and you're comfortable, or if you're on a bus that's kind of bumpy, it might seem like a long time. So there's the way it's experienced is really different from the actual concrete measures that you sometimes get. This all gets to how people actually behave. The final point, I guess, is about this sort of developer certainty. That's the other thing you often hear about streetcars. Well, developers like it because it gives them certainty, and that also seems like a rather vague reason. But what actually happens when a streetcar is put down in the street is that the space of the street changes radically, right? It's a game changer because you get instant traffic calming on the street. People are driving on tracks. They're probably driving at half the speed they were before. You get instant navigability for someone from out of town, like a lot of you, where if you see these tracks, you know you can find them again, and you can navigate through the city, and you can walk down along the streetcar line and know where you're going, right? You get instant triage. One of the things Jeff Speck talks about in his book called Walkable City is the need to choose your winners, right? We need to choose the streets in our city to focus our attention on, to make walkable. And you can only choose one or two of these places. You can't make everything walkable. So what does green mean again?
30 seconds.
Okay. You can't make everything walkable. So the streetcar idea really helps you do that triage. I call it urban triage. It's not the most pleasant image, but I think that's what streetcars do. So really, in the practical sense of how decisions are made in a city like Minneapolis or St. Paul, you get this sort of attention to quality that's missing in a lot of conversations. You get a real game changer on a street and how it feels to walk and bike and live and take the transit mode, whatever it happens to be. And there's a practical sort of political aspect to this too that I didn't quite get into, but I'm sure we're going to start talking about soon.
This is part of just 5 minutes. I'll walk slowly. All right, it's hard to follow Bill. So my name is Nick Pagrino, as I was introduced as earlier. I live in the Loring Park neighborhood, and I work in downtown Minneapolis, a few blocks from here, kind of towards City Hall. I take transit every single day. I take actually buses on Nicollet Mall, where one of these streetcars is proposed, and it's not very pleasant for a lot of reasons. It's not too bad in the morning. I work kind of early. Usually I can get a seat, but in the afternoon, it's pretty terrible. You can kind of imagine sort of the worst possible transit experience possible. You've got crying babies, folks standing in front of you, maybe haven't showered in a while. There's chickens clucking on the floor. There's people standing around with barrels with kind of cut off their hands, and they got fire going on in the barrel trying to stay warm. It's at capacity, and the streetcar proposal that we've got right now isn't actually going to really improve the mobility of anybody who lives along that route. It definitely will be a smoother ride, but I don't know that necessarily is something that I'm looking for as a current transit user. It's going to be at capacity probably right when it opens, because rail bias is a real thing, and the current bus is at capacity, and the streetcar isn't going to add that much capacity. So the day it opens, the thing's going to be jam-packed. So I don't know that that's necessarily an investment that we need to be making right now, especially because it's going to run in traffic. There's this awesome graphic that the city released that has a picture of the Nicollet streetcar, and then there's a Toyota Matrix blocking the streetcar because the car is on the tracks because it's mixed in with traffic. And so it's kind of funny that we have a Toyota Matrix kind of
stymieing like the entire region's transportation network right there. We're building a $300 million streetcar and it's running in with traffic. So it kind of just seems like a toy. I mean, rail bias is a real thing, certainly, but I don't know that we should be replicating existing transit service with a train that does the exact same thing that the bus does. It seems like there are better investments that we can make if we're thinking out in the future, a couple decades, or even maybe at present, instead of planning like it's the 90s still. There are tens of thousands of people who are going to take the Nicollet streetcar, and tens of thousands of people who would take the West 7th streetcar in St. Paul from downtown St. Paul to the airport. But we're kind of lowballing it and planning that, you know, maybe we'll have 10,000 riders, and you know, that's about what we're going to be able to accommodate with the streetcar. It just doesn't seem like very thought-out planning if we're trying to think of the city that we want to be in the next few decades. So one of the things, and I think people kind of realize that, it's not really going to be a huge transit improvement. So with the streetcar, we're trying to do transit-oriented development. We're trying to do this. We're trying to spend $300 million on the condition that we're going to get real estate redevelopment along the line. So for those of you who aren't from Minneapolis, we have this awesome example of the Nicollet and Lake Kmart that we built a few decades ago. And it's in the middle of Nicollet Avenue. We closed Nicollet Avenue, kind of our main shopping street. We stuck a Kmart in the middle of the street. And so we're going to tear that down, we're going to build a streetcar through it, and then we're going to redevelop that land. And that's a good goal, but I don't know that we necessarily need a streetcar for that. I think in the Twin Cities, we've really shown with the Blue Line, which has been open for about 10 years now, that it doesn't seem like we're actually getting a whole lot of transit-oriented development. There have been a few projects, nothing really huge. A lot of you folks, if you took the light rail from the airport to downtown Minneapolis, you probably got off at the Nicollet Mall station. There's a brand new apartment building right there. That whole block was a parking lot for 10 years after that opened in downtown Minneapolis. There hasn't been a lot of TOD that's really panned out. At Bloomington Central Station, which they had this whole plan, they were going to build thousands of units. At the Lake Street Station, a whole plan, thousands of units. And nobody really did any of it. Unfortunately, it's not actually that hard to drive in the Twin Cities metro area. It's not that expensive to do so. So the kind of people who are paying for new construction, market rate rents, still want to have a car. And I think one of the best examples of that is, you've also probably heard, we've had a kind of a recent debacle with the Southwest Corridor, where we're building a train through a park instead of through uptown. And after they made that decision about 5 years ago, we still managed to get thousands and thousands of units of development in uptown Minneapolis, even without that high quality transit option. So I don't know that transit is the thing that's necessarily driving development. So I don't know that we should be planning our transportation system that way. If it just happens, that's nice, but I don't know that we need to plan on it.
My opponent mentioned mobility, and I just want to remind everybody that mobility is not just the simple thing about time, but it's like, if you are in a wheelchair, what does mobility mean to you? It means the ability to get on and get off of a vehicle very easily. And one of the things about streetcars is they do increase capacity. So I actually want to challenge the idea that they're going to fill up right away. I'm thinking of Toronto's streetcar system, where they have kind of large vehicles, and you can tie multiple of them together. And the West 7th streetcar, for example, if it was able to move in the clogged traffic, would probably be able to carry a lot of people to and from the hockey arena or whatever you have it. Okay, so there is a capacity advantage. Replicating existing transit service, we don't need to do that. That's what my opponent just told you. Now, I think that's exactly what the cities need to do. Both Minneapolis and St. Paul need to replicate existing transit service with them in a much higher quality way. Right now we're spending, as Nick said, a lot of time developing new lines, putting them through some nice parks where nobody lives except squirrels, and they don't take transit. What we need to be doing is investing our transit improvements where existing service is located right now, and that is on these corridors. That's on Nicollet Avenue, that's on 7th Street. I've been on streetcars that have failed across the country. I've taken the Tampa streetcar, for example, and that's a depressing experience because it doesn't really go through dense neighborhoods. That's not true of these two proposals here. The value capture model, I think, is the way that cities should be moving forward because it allows them to act more independently and pressure regional transportation agencies and the regional political conversation in ways that say, well, we need to invest where existing riders are, where existing transit service is, and this is exactly what these proposals are doing, in contrast to some of the proposals you're going to hear about in the next debate.
Thank you. question?
And a question.
Another question?
Yeah, come up and ask.
Yeah, I got a question while I'm up there.
Okay. So I guess we're talking about, again, about replicating transit service. So I don't, it doesn't necessarily, it's not a bad thing to improve the service that we already have that's on Nicollet Avenue, for example, but the concern that I have is that we're spending in total about $2 billion in the south half of Minneapolis without really improving transit service for anyone who actually lives in the city. So if you count the Southwest Corridor, which ostensibly serves Minneapolis, I guess, so that's $1.7 billion, and then we're going to spend $300 million to basically replace the 18 on Nicollet Avenue. So that's $2 billion that we've spent in the city, and I think it's going to be really, really challenging in the next several decades to get any more money out of anybody if we've already spent that much money. And it would stink if we did that without actually improving service for people who use the service. Thinking of a question for Mr. Lindekey, my opponent. Do you think that it is worth it to be improving this in the way that we are? Nope. I didn't actually take high school debate. Does it seem like a good, so if we're assuming that maybe things go kind of south in the next 10 years, maybe we lose legislature in Minnesota and we have no new transit funding foreseeable over what we've got in the next 20 years, do you still think that these streetcars are a good place to spend our money? I think, now he comes back up.
Come on back, okay. Good.
That's a good question, and honestly, that's a tricky one. I wanted to do the normal thing where you answer a different question. I think that the streetcars will be a game changer, and that's kind of the way I like to think about them. I think the model of how we fund these is really tricky. One of the things I like about the Minneapolis proposal, even though it's still very vague, is that it would allow the city to act a little bit independently from the legislature or from the federal funding formula or what have you. And I know cities are doing that around the country. I'm not an expert on the funding side of it. That's going to be the real tricky situation in both cities, and that's really hard. I guess I would say that I think that this is a kind of thing where you can build political support around something like a streetcar. Although, as we've seen, you can also build political animosity around streetcars, as is shown in places like Cincinnati, where they become these incredible flashpoints. The light rail in Minneapolis and St. Paul that was just built is going to really change people's minds. People that were in St. Paul that were skeptical a little bit ago are starting to see that street corners in St. Paul, like Dale University, look totally different now. It's only been 6 months. And all of a sudden, there's all these people walking around on the street. I think things are going to be, the conversation around the streetcars and the politics of them is going to be changed.
Don't forget to ask your.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Nick. the question is, what would you see as being a game changer for transit in Minneapolis and St. Paul? I'm not talking about the suburbs. I'm talking about Minneapolis and St. Paul, okay, the two cities in the middle. What would be a game changer that you could build political support around? And I think that's the question we need to be asking ourselves. And I think streetcar is the answer.
1 minute.
That's a good question. I feel like there's no way to do that where it won't make me seem like a crazy person. you know, it's hard. Because we have a regional transit formula. We get money from a sales tax that a lot of people pay into that do not live in Minneapolis or St. Paul, unfortunately. I think one thing that we could be doing a little bit more of is making an argument about fiscal responsibility and telling people who are giving us money who live in suburban counties or suburban municipalities other than in the central cities, and telling them that we're actually saving money on operating costs when we're building, for example, heavy rail or light rail over streetcars or over buses, because most of the expenses for a lot of these transit agencies are coming from actually paying people to drive a bus around. In a light rail vehicle or even a heavy rail vehicle can carry a lot more people. I think you can also make that kind of argument around, hopefully, you know, if we're getting maybe we're getting some more TOD in 20 years. If we have a high-quality transit option that can get you from uptown to downtown in 10 minutes, I think you would obviously have a lot more options, and maybe we could take advantage of some of the growth in tax base in those areas.
Let's hear it from these guys. Your questions have to be short, that, you know, we're going to cut you off. It turns out we had already figured out who presenter one and presenter two is, and like who's talking on what, so I apologize to those first two for me not seeing my notes. Next is regional transit with a general topic. With the future regional rail transit links, are LRT plans and improving service to low-income communities? Oh, are they? Are the plans improving service to low-income communities? Are our planning processes resulting in equitable outcomes? Or something like that. But we told our panelists, you can take it in different directions. And our two panelists for this topic are presenter one, because we already figured that out, Alex Cicchini. Alex is a mechanical engineer by background, currently working in marketing and business development. He lives with his wife, young son, and two poorly behaved dogs just south of uptown Minneapolis. And presenter two, Jana Flissrand. Did I get that right? All right. Jana spends her time thinking about how people interact with the space around them. Her consulting work has resulted in Minnesota's adoption of green requirements for affordable multifamily housing, including land use and transportation access requirements. She is one of the founders of the Minneapolis Bicycle Coalition, and she raises 10 kinds of fruit in her perennial garden on a small urban lot. She earned her MA in urban anthropology from the University of Memphis after teaching in Zaire, now Democratic Republic of Congo, for 18 months. Thank you in advance to our panelists. And presenter one, Alex, come on up. Your 5 minutes starts right now.
I'm going to get an image up here.
It's tough to be presenter one.
Up, up, up. Full screen.
There you go. All right, so hopefully you guys, everybody can see that. If not, squint. That's my answer. So my name is Alex again. So I'll skip kind of the intro that I had and just say that I believe that rail transit, as planned in the Twin Cities, will both improve service to low-income communities and will seek to improve equity. So what do I mean by planned rail that we have going on right now in the Twin Cities? Well, we've got the streetcars that Bill and Nick just talked about, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, and what looks to be a whole nother one in Minneapolis, West Broadway, potentially. But we've also got two light rails being planned, the Bottineau Blue Rail, or Blue Line Extension, and the Green Line Extension out to the southwest burbs, and then in all likelihood probably the Riverview corridor between the airport and downtown St. Paul will probably be light rail. We also have a streetcar that will be running in the Midtown Greenway, so that's that sunken old rail corridor that's great for biking and walking today, but looks like it'll be rail between the Green Line Extension and the Blue Line. So we've got a lot of rail planned, and with that in mind, we kind of need to understand poverty in the region first, and that's what this upper left map is. Here, the purple shaded areas are what's called regional or racially concentrated areas of poverty. And you can see, if you can see, the three maps below it show the expansion of that over the last couple decades. And what we're seeing is a continued concentration of poverty within the core cities, but also pockets that are growing out into the suburbs. And this is a national phenomenon. This isn't just located in the Twin Cities here. And it's a problematic thing because, you know, people of lower means moving out to the suburbs may see access to jobs in the short term, may improve education opportunities with better schools, but at the same time, they see higher costs of transportation, owning vehicles, one, two vehicles to get around. If, you know, jobs, you lose your job, you know, all of a sudden you're isolated in a quadrant of the region that doesn't have access to maybe some of the jobs that you might have had access to were you in the core. So, you know, the initial reaction from transit people that are maybe opposed to the regional transit plans that we have is that serving the suburbs, particularly by rail, is very costly. And that's because, you know, there's not a good street network, there's a lot of barriers between highways and things like that. Things are very spread out. But, you know, we need to remember that that doesn't mean that the physical and human capital that exists out there, all the jobs, the buildings that are there that house those jobs, cost millions of dollars. The sewers, the roads, the streets, the highways, those are multi-millions of dollars of investment that they're not going anywhere for the next 30, 50 plus years. People are still going to be working there. People aren't going to be selling their homes en masse just because, you know, we're not going to build this rail line out to there. And as you can see in the second map on the right, it's kind of hard to tell, but the reds and oranges are jobs per acre, and you can see concentrations, particularly ones that are the skills are required by lower income people outside of the core. There are clearly a lot in the core, but you can see Hopkins, Minnetonka, Eden Prairie, Bloomington is jam packed with these jobs and in concentrated pockets. And conveniently enough, lines like the green line, the extension, the dotted line out to the southwest there, hits pretty much all of them. So, you know, that's a major part of it too. From an equity perspective, all these stations out in the suburbs that we're planning, even the stations along the streetcars and the urban parts, they improve walkability, they improve bikeability around them. You can see the maps in the bottom right. The white bubbles are the existing walk sheds, and the yellow bubbles are the planned walk sheds post day one station launch. That's huge. Safety for bikers and peds is disproportionately bad for low-income residents, and not to mention people that are disabled, elderly. These type of improvements are huge for them from an equity perspective. Transit's presence out in the suburbs, especially where there's empty parking lots, very low-cost land, justifies cheaper housing. Affordable housing, 12.5% of the cost of affordable housing is oftentimes in structured parking. So if we can reduce that, because there's access to rail transit that's high amenity, that's high frequency, that accesses all sorts of jobs, that's great. Market rate apartments are oftentimes, they see 35% of their cost of the rent is built in with structured parking. So being able to build more because we've got places out in the suburbs on cheap land that are accessible to rail that you don't have to own a car, that's all great. Lastly, other transit improvements come along with rail. Bus improvements, frequency, rerouting to coordinate with the rail, and obviously beyond just these rail transit investments that we're making, we're also doing arterial bus rapid transit and a few other things as well. So that all comes along with it. So yes, we need to do better in terms of the methodology of projecting ridership. We need to lower the cost of the rail projects themselves, you know, less structured parking, things like that. And we can do more to encourage TOD on day one, but overall the lines, the destinations, the safety improvements, it's all great for equity and low income residents.
Push the PowerPoint to the side further. Just drag it. There you go.
That's
that's a nice photo.
We'll just leave it like this. Yeah. So I cannot think of any metric on which our future LRT and high-speed transit links are actually providing significant improved service to low-income communities. Rather, a few poorly planned, supposedly low-income stations are serving as cover to spend exorbitant sums of money on express service to very high-income communities. I'll make my point using three examples and highlighting the crazy process that we use for what we call engagement, one that is heavily tilted towards the privileged. We have long underserved low-income communities with a transportation system, as highlighted in this picture of one of the most inhumane and heavily used bus stops in our region. We are prioritizing amenities and investments in suburban park and rides over frequent, predictable service to communities that are transit-friendly and disproportionately transit-dependent. We continue to repeat those types of investments. Let me show you the next three examples that the Met Council is planning to build. Supposedly. So this is the Southwest LRT. One we heard about from the streetcar folks already. And this is a poster child for our planning priorities. The darker red are wealthier communities. The darkest red is a medium income of $100,000 a year per household or more. The image on the right, it highlights the city's preferred route versus the chosen route. Rather than choosing the green line that goes through the lower income communities with some of the highest transit ridership in the region, the Met Council chose a route through a park with lots of squirrels, poor connectivity, track between lakes, very few people, and a wealthy car-dependent neighborhood. I think you can see the lack of streets in the red there, where it goes on the left-hand side. The outcome is very fast for suburban riders, with access for urban riders only via multiple transfers. While there is access, transfers clearly are a problem. Ironically, the wealthy Minneapolitans are suing to stop the train. The second example is the Botno Corridor. And again, the route is surprisingly similar. You can see that to the west, we again have a route that's going through a park, again lacking people and again lacking connectivity. To the east, we have a route that's going through walkable traditional neighborhoods where there are again significant numbers of transit-dependent people. And again, we selected the fastest travel times that go through the park as our locally preferred alternative prioritizes high-income and suburban riders. The last example is the Gateway Corridor, and you'll recognize the trend by now. Thanks to Brendan Slaughterback and other Streets MN writer, I can report that this plan serves only about 9,000 riders at $50,000 per rider, rather than stopping the route in the transit-friendly, traditionally built areas where it's more cost-effective and serves lower-income households. We're designing it to reach communities where the median household incomes clearly reach $100,000 a year or more. If we really want to serve low-income communities as we build out our major transit corridors, we need to prioritize routes through built-out low-income communities. And until we do that consistently and as a matter of policy, we are not providing equitable access to transit. Now, I also wanted to talk about the process. And anyone who has participated in traditional public comment processes knows that they are arcane. The timeline is way too long to feel relevant. I submitted comments on the Southwest LRT route years before the locally preferred alternative was finalized in 2010. It's not yet funded or built. Finding out about those processes is a crapshoot, and offering meaningful comments requires reading lengthy reports written in jargon, and that assumes that submitting comments is a meaningful act as well. Even I find it intimidating. I'm obsessed with transportation policy. I have a master's degree in a related field, and I do it all the time. We've set up a system where the only group of people motivated to engage deeply are homeowners trying to stop change in their own communities. That process cannot lead to equitable results. Now, rather than ending on that depressing note, I want to add that we can choose to design a process that has more relevant and equitable outcomes. We can invest public outreach time at transit stops along possible routes and ask the people who are there for their preferences. We can use participant observation to test out key destination-to-destination routes from underserved communities and with different route alternatives. We can also measure the travel time savings of those different options. We can choose to repeat our inequitable planning processes that pretend to constitute engagement and that are accessible only to the very educated and the motivated. Or, I would argue, we must design it to show us equitable outcomes that will serve all riders. We're not doing that today.
First thought, as Yana shows on this last image, I think we proved that we can build very high cost per rider transit systems that aren't rail. This is a highway BRT, so you know the typical response that we always get is that rail is very expensive and we should be building bus lines. That's maybe something that we should challenge, and you know we've seen a lot of the suburban routes that are, it doesn't matter if they're rail or bus. Another thought that I have, you talked about time for commuters from the suburbs and as being a primary reason for the route choices that were made, particularly on Southwest Light Rail. And I will not dispute that that was definitely part of it. In fact, federal funding rules and the formulas and everything have changed since the alternative analysis and DIS came out. So obviously we are making improvements, but that wasn't the only factor at play. Obviously cost to build lines in certain locations plays a big factor. Using existing rail corridors and places that are cheap to build, the alternatives were far more expensive. Obviously, for Southwest, we've run into issues of building tunnels through the parklands with all the squirrels. Not exactly the optimal situation, but at the same time, it's difficult to predict what the cost adders could have been running in an alternate world through Uptown. Even if I really do believe that Uptown maybe should have been served. but it's hard. Suburbs are the locations of these lines, and you highlight that they're in very wealthy neighborhoods, that represents a huge opportunity for equity, especially for economic and social integration. Building housing, like I mentioned before, in areas that are underutilized today, mixing economic people of different economic backgrounds by building along these rail lines or along these transit lines that give them access to both jobs, but also the schools that are out there, the economic opportunities, that's a huge opportunity. And like it or not, Minneapolis, as much as I'd love to grow the population by 100,000 or 500,000, very difficult politically to do, financially to do, and those areas out on those rail corridors represent a big opportunity. And do I have a question?
Oh, no, you don't. No, Yana goes with 2 minutes with a good question.
So my opponent claims that we can get affordability in suburban locations by reducing parking requirements. Now, while I am the first person to say we should reduce parking requirements, I am very skeptical about the political feasibility of reducing parking requirements in any of the suburban communities that are served where you have this more affordable land. So while I would love the idea, as somebody who works in affordable housing and has seen the requirements suburban communities place upon that affordable housing, I am skeptical of that being a viable thing. Secondarily, if you're talking about the cost of alternatives, I would love to point out that with Southwest LRT, the reason we went for the park with the squirrels is because it was cheaper and it was going to be too expensive to build through the developed community. We have found that instead we get to build lots of tunnels through parks and not serve anybody along the way, and that the cost we are currently looking at is the cost that it would have been to go through the urban community before. So it is possible that there would have been other adders and that we're making a different choice than we should have. However, I am skeptical of whether that is actually a good way of spending it and whether that cost argument really holds water over time. Finally, you're talking about access to jobs, and I'm going to point at this map once again. It is true that it would be great if you could have increased access to jobs in those high-end communities on the eastern end, but I look at that and I see the street network. I don't see how anybody who's getting off a bus on the western end of that route is actually going to be able to get from that stop to their job unless somebody does an astoundingly amazing job with circulators and additional buses. And frankly, I don't see how you would run additional buses to job centers given the street connectivity that is lacking in those communities. So while I hope all of those things are true, my observation in the Twin Cities metro is that I don't think we're actually likely to achieve that. Now I do have a question for you. So if you found yourself, because our question also included this question about process and equitable access to the process so that all communities could have influence on the decisions being made, if you found yourself at a transit stop with a low-income person, how would you encourage them to get engaged in shaping the future of our transit system here regionally to make their own life better? How would you ensure that their engagement would be meaningful, even if they may not still be in the same place years to come when that would be coming to fruition? How could they at least make it meaningful for the community that they live in now? Give us equitable access to process.
So Alex, a total of 2 minutes to answer and ask a question.
Sure. Well, that's a very tough question to answer. I think, you know, the Metropolitan Council and MetTransit, when they're doing planning, they're in a tough position because meeting all people of economic backgrounds, it's very difficult. You get a lot of people with odd hours that they work. You know, having a meeting at 5 p.m. Serves people that are getting off a 8-to-5 job very well. It might not serve other people that work night shifts very well. And the flip side would be true doing 10 a.m. meetings, and I know that they do a very good job trying to reach out to those people. To be honest with you, I'm not sure how to improve other than on-bus sessions, you know, people like you mentioned at a transit stop, but on-bus sessions with people real-time getting their thoughts, you know, while they're riding, that's something that's huge. I'm not sure, to be honest. That's a tough question. Maybe I'll open up to the panel. Does anybody else have
any questions? They can ask their question as long as they were in person.
Sure. I'll leave it at that, but maybe I'll ask your question or a question to you. So, what is your prescription for cost effectively serving areas across our metro in which there are many, many more jobs and amenities outside the two core cities, which is an unfortunate reality, that are not very transit accessible? What would your prescription be for giving access to people of all economic backgrounds by transit or otherwise in a cost-effective manner?
Throughout the entire seven-county region.
Well, let's,
in 1 minute.
Let's say we'll limit it to inside the 494 Beltway.
So I think that we cannot possibly upend everything about transportation and transit and how it works. And so I think that if we want to give equitable access and the best opportunity to the most people possible, we really need to focus on some of these some triage options, make sure that we are giving people who live in very transit accessible areas access to as many jobs as possible. That's going to mean increasing frequency in those high concentration areas that you had on that map, and focusing on those areas, not trying to serve the entire 7 County Metro, because it is, or the entire inside the 494, 694 Beltway. There is simply no way with our land use development patterns for us to serve every single business in that area. So we need to focus on doing the most, the best, not trying to serve every job location everywhere.
Right. You're going to fill out comment cards later. They're going to say, we want more debates. This is fantastic. Thank you to the panelists so far. Now, I have gotten the most comments on this next topic. If you are not from the Twin Cities, raise your hand. Okay. Skyways are those things in the air. Basic bit of definition. So our next topic is skyways. As a byproduct of an auto-oriented time, what do we do with them now? Presenter one, who could it be? My friend Sam Newberg. Sam is a founder and president of Joe Urban, where he provides real estate consulting services and is a writer for a variety of publications, including Streets.mn, Urban Land Magazine, and his own website, which is www.joe-urban.com. He also guest lectures at and gives presentations on urbanism in a variety of settings, and he's an activist for better urbanism in his neighborhood, city, and beyond. Sam is presenter one in a moment, and presenter two is Cameron Conway. Cameron fell head over heels for cities while living in D.C. and Seattle. Now in Minneapolis, he advocates for equitable urbanism through the Midtown Greenway Coalition, the CARAG Neighborhood Board, and the Minneapolis Bicycle Coalition. He wants to build dynamic urbanism in your parking lots. So I'm checking my time. Come on, Sam, you're presenter one. Here we go.
Thank you, thank you. Hi, everybody. How many of you have been in the Skyway system today? Oh, that's too many of you. The rest of you, don't bother. Yeah, just go across the street to the piazza on the mall. That's a much better use of scarce public resources to create a great, high-quality public space. There we go. There we are. Here we go. Wait. Go. Isn't it about time to start tearing down our skyways? Noted urbanists have visited us and pointed out that there are many drawbacks. In the 1980s, Fred Kent from PPS noticed how internalized the skyways made us. Carol Coletta said, we certainly shouldn't build anymore. A few years ago, Jan Gehl was in town and noted that downtown Minneapolis was no longer up to the beat of other world-class winter cities. He was blaming the skyways for striking a defensive posture against nature. Gil Penalosa cautioned us on building something for 2 bad weeks out of the year and ignoring the other 50. Even local leaders now understand the conundrum that skyways put us in, but they like their warmth. It would be simpler to just get rid of them. The strategy is easy. Remove one skyway per year and nobody will really notice when they're gone. See, that's borrowing from Jan Gehl's, a chapter from Jan Gehl's strategy in Copenhagen for parking, by the way. So see, the original intent of the skyways has not really panned out. The first skyways were built in the early to mid 60s, largely as a defense against the loss of retailing to the suburbs, as well as a clever way to grade segregate pedestrians from cars. Both 1960s thinking. Early renderings weren't even climate controlled, but open air bridges, yet we've become so accustomed to not putting on a jacket in the winter that we cling to our skyways like Charlton Heston clinged to his guns.
Ooh.
All the while, wait for it, okay. All the while they detract heavily from pedestrian life because they literally draw people off the sidewalks. So we have to repeatedly spend millions rebuilding Nicollet Mall just to draw people outside. As William White pointed out in his book, City, Rediscovering the Center, what cities sorely need is more people on the streets, not fewer. But we add skyways and wonder why our streets remain dead. Skyways' impact on urban design cannot be ignored. Even when we don't deliberately design buildings with blank walls facing the streets, we struggle to populate ground floor retail with anything except destination restaurants, because the skyways compete for everyday retail and convenience goods. As William White also pointed out, a downtown can support only so many stores and restaurants, and something has to give. We didn't save downtown retail against suburbanization, and for all the small skyway retailers, it's simply a function of supply and demand. 135,000 workers still need coffee, lunch, and convenience retail, and food trucks have pointed out in the past couple of years, they've demonstrated that people will go outside to the street if there's a reason to do so. Office tenants won't flee either. I don't think so. They're downtown because of light rail, restaurants, sports facilities, entertainment. In other words, the center of it all. That won't change if skyways are gone. But an improved public realm will attract and enhance that, particularly as a way to attract younger millennials downtown. Ground floor space can be converted back to retail if foot traffic exists. Downtown also gets bifurcated socially. After recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, and the arrest of an African-American man in the St. Paul Skyway system, which incidentally is public space, this should give us pause. If a decent-sized group of us, well-dressed professionals, were to go into the Skyway system as a group of people, we would very likely get accosted by a security guard within minutes. Right, Bill? It's happened. Yeah. As any elected official truly concerned about equality should acknowledge this as a problem. Do you realize that it's possible to drive downtown, park in one of several parking ramps, go to work, shop, and never set foot on a public sidewalk? I think that's insane, and it doesn't fit with my definition of urban. Downtown should be downtown. And while our plans call for a strong pedestrian environment, we continually add to the skyway system against our best judgment. Some of you will say, remove skyways over my dead body. Well, that sort of is the point. We've had them for 50 years, and surely we can be rid of them in another 50. Our memory is short. Downtown street life naturally thrived for decades before the skyways were built and has struggled to do so ever since. We celebrate being outdoors in winter, and yet we shy away from it when we're downtown. Minneapolis must become a more attractive urbane city with a better pedestrian environment by redirecting scarce dollars away from building and maintaining our skyways and instead improving the public realm. Downtown Minneapolis can indeed become a better place for people year-round. Thank you.
My name is Cameron. I grew up in Virginia Beach, Virginia, which is rather suburban in its design and falls to a lot of the same cruxes that our skyway system and our downtown do, as far as design that really prioritizes kind of a very private space. And so I think a lot of the problems that Stan points out with our skyway system are from that kind of design pattern. And so one thing that I just want to kind of talk about is the idea that we're in an era where our priorities are shifting very sharply as far as what we need to be building in our cities, what direction we need to be taking as far as public versus private space, whether or not we're going to take the capital we have, keep it on our indoors, or keep it in a place that is publicly accessible. And so this is why the skyway debate is so very difficult, because in a way, there's more than just one factor going on. There's not just auto-centric kind of privatization. It's not just office workers or, I guess, tenants trying to keep their private atriums away from everyone else. It's more than that. It's the fact that not only do we have skyways, but nearly every other city that has a temperature range in North America, like ours, also has a skyway system. A skyway or a subway system. This includes Toronto, Montreal, Edmonton, Calgary, Duluth, Cedar Rapids, and our neighbor St. Paul. So when looking at the skyway dilemma, it's really important to me to make sure that we're delineating between what is auto-centric design, what is actually an amenity that makes urban interactions easier in the Twin Cities. And so, let's see. As far as the actual objections that Sam has to the skyways, I don't actually disagree a lot. I more disagree on the path going forward. And so I just want to touch on why the skyways are actually kind of nice for those who actually can access them. And I would agree that there are some access issues that I will address in just a moment. For the people who love it, they are a way to get around town very quickly. Very few towns actually have a high-speed pedestrian ways. in a way. You know, those of you who've been to New York and have taken local and express trains, you love that express train. And honestly, the Minneapolis Skyway system is the largest uninterrupted continuous pedestrian network, potentially in North America, if not the world. You can walk and walk and walk and walk, and you can access the entirety of downtown very easily. I will say that it is very difficult to get into the Skyway, but that is an issue. Now, this allows for some truly urban interactions between people for a time of the year when that just can't happen on the ground floor. I don't know how many of you were stopping to talk to your neighbor during this last February or so. I know that I was saying, hey, how's it going, and brushing by very quickly. In the Skyway, not only are people given a space to athleticize and walk around in the middle of the wintertime, but it also gives them a chance to kind of brush elbows with fellow people. And so, two things. I just want to say that taking down the Skyway system is an exercise in some very difficult top-down governance as far as convincing building owners to actually do it. We're talking about removing million-dollar investments that not only increase the rent that they can charge tenants. Buildings in the Skyway system cost more than those outside of the Skyway system, but it also allows for all the people in those buildings to access those amenities. In addition to that, this is if we're talking about actually reinvigorating our ground floor, that is a costly endeavor. That will mean not only physically restructuring every element on the first and second floor of all of these Skyway systems, it also means tampering with the way that the tenants have kind of laid out their systems for these areas. Some of the first floor are atriums, some of the first floors are parking garages. Not all of them are at all compatible to retrofitting. And I think that we need to be making sure that we are choosing a path forward that is feasible for those who we will be essentially telling, hey, that thing you really, really like in negative 15, we're going to take it away.
Same for my bad. All
right. So if we keep the Skyway system, let's keep in mind that each new Skyway costs more than $1 million to construct, and in many cases, a lot more. Now, they are private space, and that cost is mostly borne by the private sector. So although the public is actually paying for the Skyway extension to the new football stadium in downtown Minneapolis, while the public park remains unfunded, why is that? Imagine if we could put those millions of dollars towards actually improving the public realm first, like better sidewalks, lighting, planting trees, adding benches, fountains, and art. We already have sidewalks, and to me, a second set of pedestrian routes is kind of costly and redundant. So if we keep them, and we're also spending a lot of time with the current redesign that's going on of Nicollet Mall, which is the third redesign of Nicollet Mall in our history, and we've been struggling with how to relate to the Skyways, getting to and from them. And there are, yes, good ideas coming out from James Cornerfield with outdoor stairways and that sort of thing to sort of make it a little more intuitive to get to and from the Skyway system and the sidewalk. But it's at an extreme cost, and it really requires a lot of, it's just so much easier to have a bunch of doors that open out on the sidewalks that already exist and not have to worry about getting to and from that second level. So is it really worth the cost? I guess my question then, is it worth the cost of continually spending more and more dollars to try to fix this problem when long term we could cut our losses by getting rid of the system entirely?
So I think that one thing that's tough is that we have a few different kinds of costs here. We have the physical cost of the Skyway system, but we also have the cost of the thing that I just completely forgot. I do apologize for that. So one thing that I just want to say is, it's a really, really tough question. I think that to continue to, first of all, I just want to point out that I don't think the Nicollet Mall redesigns have been at all Skyway-centric. I think that most of them have been largely based on the ground floor that Sam does champion, and we still haven't gotten it right. And that honestly goes to point as to what I think is actually wrong with downtown Minneapolis's ground level. It's not so much that there's skyways above, but there's just blank facades everywhere. On the two streets we do have that have relatively consistent storefronts, and when you're thinking about Nicollet Mall, it's not necessarily even that consistent. You have maybe one or two doors per block, the other one being Hennepin Avenue, which does have relatively consistent storefronts. These two streets are not for want for pedestrians during the summertime. They are actively used. What we need is not necessarily to destroy the skyways up ahead in order to change the design of downtown Minneapolis. We need to just change the design of downtown Minneapolis. And I don't think that by dismantling the one thing that gets us between these dynamic places in the wintertime is actually conducive towards that goal. So.
And a question for Sam.
The question that I have for Sam is, what would you do to, it's saying that you're a part of a municipal government of some kind, what would you do to kind of incentivize building owners to do what you'd like them to do with their private property?
Any answer to your question?
Yes. What would I do? It's a good question, my worthy opponent. I gave myself a lot of flexibility by saying it's a 50-year plan, right? But so you take one. You'd have to start somewhere, so who's going to want to take the dive on that, right? All these building owners kind of count on them to have skyways for revenue and for the way tenants lay out in the building. So you'd have to find someone who's willing to try it, and then again the next year, and again the next year, and you wouldn't want to do it all, maybe all in one section of the city. You maybe just kind of do it piecemeal, so the most of the system exists, but you can't walk from one end of downtown to the other, which I think that's a little overstated as far as how many people do that, but I could be wrong. I would hope that enough arm wrestling among elected officials and leaders with, you know, business owners and building owners could achieve a realization that while there is a benefit to having skyways, warmth, you know, you don't have to cross streets that there are drawbacks, and getting enough people to understand that. And there's a, let's characterize it as this, there's a small minority who do understand it, and if you can get a few more who are in key decision-making roles and maybe a key building owner, then maybe we do temporary closings of skyways instead of taking them down. Just kind of a test for a week or something, just to see how it goes, and maybe the world won't end. So I need to have a question for you now. Okay, so I have not been to Toronto or Montreal, Cameron. So what are the key differences between our Skyway system and their tunnel system, and how do they function better?
Well, 1 minute answer.
I will start by answering that by lamenting the fact that we do not have Chicago's elevated train system in our city, because if we did, we'd actually have the kind of station area possibilities that are in fact in place within Montreal's REZO system. Montreal has a rather extensive underground rail system for a metropolitan area of its size, and it also has a relatively extensive REZO system, which is their underground city. And so while we have seen, I'm sure many of you have seen, great station areas that with lots of pedestrian facilities in many cities like Washington, D.C. or New York, that all exists in Montreal underground. You walk out of the subway station, you immediately are greeted with shops, with retail, with engaging pedestrian space. And I think that works really well because it means you can be as urban as you want to.
Albert is walking around, so say thank you to her as she comes by, and she's going to take your question, and she's going to take a lot of the credit for this this here debate thing. So people have been handing me some questions, so here's how this is going to go. I'm not going to try to figure out who they're for.
I'm going to just run these up.
Yeah, Kathy's bringing me some questions.
Thank you. See
all
how
right,
you're doing? Thank you, Kathy.
Go.
Thank you. I'm not going to try to figure out who they're for. I'm going to take the ones that seem compelling, and I'm going to fire them at the panel. Panel, they don't necessarily have to be for anyone on any of the panels. If you think it relates to the question that you were addressing, I want you to answer. It's okay if you talk over each other a little. We're going to be a little Saturday Night Live-like, because that's fun. And no one answer from the panel can be longer than 1 minute. Okay? Everyone's going to get a chance. We're going to hear from everyone again. So raise your hand after you've written a question. I'll walk around. I'll also be trying to keep track of these people, and we'll keep this lively. Is everyone good
right.
so far? You love debates, right? All right. Regional transit. I guess somebody identified who this is for. What about regional incentives to move large employers to transit-friendly locations? Go.
No.
There's no dead air. Somebody start talking.
Go.
Sounds costly. I think my take would be do a cost benefit analysis. How many employers are you going to get? Where are they going to be located? What does it cost to serve transit to those new locations if they're already existing? Versus what does it cost? Let's say Southwest Light Rail. You know, $1.6 billion. How many employers and employees are you serving? You know, what was the cost benefit trade off of doing that?
Let's not get into a race to the bottom to subsidize the most. Let's use our dollars to provide services rather than to bribe people to do things that, if we set up the incentives right, they will do naturally.
I think it's like this. I saw one in the back. Anybody else want to say anything on that? Okay. What if you close Skyways as an open streets event?
I have the exact same thought. I just wanted to say that. I have the exact same thought, and unfortunately, I think that is about as realistic as OpenStreet's goal of closing all of our major streets 365 days a year, unfortunately.
Kind of defeats the purpose, because there is already no street, so, although, you know, with that said, there's the golf tournament in the Skyways, and there are creative events going on in the Skyways that are probably pretty fun for people who actually go in the Skyways, and I can't speak from experience, so someone else will have to do that.
Anybody else on that one?
How would you get to Subway if you couldn't get in the Skyway?
Wow.
Like that was
deep.
Never mind.
I think Skyways could be really interesting art projects. You could flood them, make them aquariums. You could,
there you go. Fish tank.
Like little bird things, butterfly, Skyway, just filled with butterflies.
You could put a bird on
the aviary.
Anybody? Okay. Why do we worry about helping people travel the last mile after a transit trip when so many people need the exercise?
I think honestly, I think it's changing mindsets, you know, and like all of a sudden, if you start seeing the walk as an opportunity to stroll and be outside instead of a trudge through a horrible world, people walk on purpose in other places. Other cities, and they don't seem to do that here often enough.
Yeah, it is sort of bizarre that walking has become exercise. I don't know. It just seems like a thing that should happen. Problem.
Anybody over here on that? Okay. Why doesn't anyone stress the energy source for a streetcar? Electricity is a renewable resource.
Well, maybe. Half of it is here.
Depending on where you get it, yep.
Yeah.
I did say that. I did say electricity. Yeah, it's great. I mean, electricity is great. You can also electrify buses. We should electrify a lot of transit.
Well, electric buses are quiet too, and that was one of your other points. That is the quiet ride, which
It's kind of difficult though if you're gonna invest a lot of money in that infrastructure. Why not make it a streetcar as well?
Anybody over here?
Well, that is a challenge. I mean, Minnesota is relatively ahead of the game in the Midwest in terms of its renewables plan, but for the time being, we still are very coal heavy. So electricity definitely cleaner than gasoline for sure, but you know, across the country, it's not exactly the same question, debate, depending on where you are. So, anything?
Okay. At the end of a 30-minute transit trip, I am 30 minutes older, regardless of my so-called experience. If we trick people into feeling satisfied with longer trips, aren't we wasting their lives?
I think I should take that one.
I think Bill should take that one.
You guys are awesome.
Did The journey is the experience. You sit on a train, and that is what I look forward to. I love riding the Green Line and looking out the window and hearing people's conversations and talking to my friend and reading a book. That's what life is all about. The city should not be a place you just have to get through. The experience on the train is what you want. That's why you're there. That is it. There's nothing else.
I'd say after... there we go, yeah. I'd say after my 30-minute drive, I'm an hour older.
Did anyone see the blog post about the guy who calculated the cost of driving versus the cost of Uber? And he included the opportunity cost of the time he couldn't be working because he was driving, and assumed that half of the time he was riding the Uber, he could be walking. So depending on how you use your time on the train, maybe it shortens your day by an hour in the office, and you actually get all of that time back.
This is until our autonomous cars allow us to drive in from Faribault from, you know, 80 miles away every day and do work in the cars. So.
There's a question in a minute about driverless cars. Anybody else have one? All right, I'm going to transition us back to slightly more serious topics. Which is a more effective transit investment, a streetcar mostly in mixed traffic or BRT mostly in dedicated lanes?
Depends where it is.
Take one.
Jeez, the mixed traffic streetcar is that we didn't really get into that, and that's a tough one. I mean, my goal would be that we would build a mixed traffic streetcar, people would see how nice it is, and then they would say, let's not have cars, let's get rid of that Toyota Matrix. and then it would be a two-phase sort of implementation, because it'd be really tough to tell people Nicollet Avenue is not going to have any cars right away.
It also depends on the urban context, how walkable each station area is. It also depends on how many boarding doors there are on the bus and how many and how attractive the station itself is and how user-friendly. Those are all factors as well.
I would, if you read my comments on Star Tribune articles, I'm as big a champion for dedicated lanes as anybody, but I will say Minneapolis and St. Paul seem to have very few arterials where there is room for dedicated lanes unless you were to literally, we don't have the eight-lane boulevards that New York or many other metropolitan areas have, and as much of a fan as I am, I don't know that how feasible that is on many arterials, so that's a thought.
Okay. How much or how little affordable housing should be built along light rail corridors? I had to transition us back to Sirius, right? Anybody?
So as an affordable housing professional who loves this kind of question, one of the things I've been talking about for the last 10 years is that building affordable housing, where you are obliging everyone to live in that unit, everyone who lives in that building to purchase a car in order to have a life, is not affordable in the long term, and I don't think that's a surprise to very many people. There certainly are lots of complicated issues around that topic, and thinking about how we can do more affordable housing in higher income communities that are also transit accessible is really critical. If I were choosing my own home, I would rather live in an impacted community that has access to transit than in an unimpacted community where I had to have a car. That's my choice. I think we should make sure we have choices for everyone, but let's make sure we can meet the demand for affordable housing that has transit access before saying we can't build any more of it.
I don't think we'll ever actually meet the demand at the way we fund and the pace at which we approve affordable housing. From that point of view, it all should be near transit. And there's endless capacity, land capacity for it.
I think there's a real legitimate hazard in selling a lot of these lines based on real estate development and increasing the value of the land around the stations and then having to subsidize the development that supposedly was going to happen because we built the transit line. And so that's something we need to keep in mind. Not just because of internet commenters, but
we have to subsidize affordable housing wherever it happens because the cost of construction is too high, and so you might as well subsidize it where transit exists. And you can probably build less parking and reduce the cost of the building itself.
On the flip side, there's a debate right now in the Twin Cities about where should affordable housing at, how we need more of it in the suburbs that have good school systems, and we're not building it right now. So I think it's very important to take a place like Edina or Apple Valley or Eden Prairie and build affordable housing in those places.
I think another key piece is to make sure that we make building affordable housing more affordable. At the moment, we force a lot of unnecessary costs onto our affordable housing. And so thinking about how can we make sure that we're zoning our cities appropriately so that developers can actually make the numbers pencil out while building less expensive housing is a really great first step, in addition to the subsidy that is required for truly low-income housing. And you're never going to be able to house people at 30% of median income in market rate properties. It's just not going to happen because they're not making enough money. However, we can certainly do something about people making 80% of median income if we change our standards.
Moving on to a different kind of transit and a question. Will streetcars improve transportation equity? That's what the question says, so you can't ask me for a definition.
It's all about the details. Where do we put it? How do we design connectivity to the communities surrounding it? And are we thoughtful about meeting the needs of the people who live in those communities? So it's all a question of, are we paying attention to where we're putting them and doing it right, making sure we're addressing those neighborhoods' needs? Depending on where we put it, we might just be serving really high-income neighborhoods, and those are the choices we've been making thus far.
I think the Green Line is a really good model for what a streetcar will look like. I mean, unfortunately, it's almost the slowest one most of the time. And, but if you ride it through St. Paul, you see the real diversity of the neighborhoods that are there and the people that are riding on it, and it's one of the few places in the city. I lived in St. Paul for a long time, where I see people from all incomes and all backgrounds hanging out in the same area. We have a very divided and segregated city in general, and having these kinds of things in the middle of our cities as places where everybody exists and shares space is really important. And the streetcar proposals on the tables in both cities do that. Anybody else?
One of the serious streetcar proposals that we have right now is the West Broadway streetcar, which I think we kind of threw out as a bone after we decided that Botno was going to skip North Minneapolis. And I think the planned route has it going on West Broadway that's leading down to Washington. So I imagine if you're actually taking the streetcar from West Broadway and Penn, it's probably going to take considerably longer than if you were just taking the 19 and going down Penn over to Olson. So I don't know that it will really be much of a mobility improvement. I guess it'll be more comfortable, but choosing it probably kind of take another 10 minutes or so to get to downtown Minneapolis, so not actually an improvement.
Anybody else? Okay. Question, whoever mentioned onboard user surveys, that's a great idea. Do you know who has done them?
So I've certainly heard presentations at anthropology conferences of people who have done participant observation on buses. And done other sorts of research like that. So if somebody really wants to know, track me down afterwards and I will try and get you a name.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, I read a blog recently, and I can't remember what city it was. Maybe I could look it up too, but there was, they sat at the front of the bus and asked people who were sitting there questions, so I can't remember. But
okay. Maybe they
I would question the word survey. So surveys are not inherently bad, but I don't think that surveys are going to get the full kind of input that you need. You need to think about different sorts of gathering user information, including participant observation and open-ended interviews.
So in an open-ended interview, we can find out the answer to this question. Which future mode of transit do you think will have the biggest impact on transit in the Twin Cities? Driverless cars, personal rapid transit, and hoverboards.
Driverless cars are an interesting topic, and especially because you take parking spots out of the equation, and you also ownership is able to be shared. I think that's by far. Hoverboards are cool, though.
Considering the dependence on the automobile, I think, driverless cars will have the most impact overall. I'm not sure how much they'll actually reduce traffic, and I'm not sure, I have to be convinced of how they relate to urban situations like jaywalking and this stuff that happens every day, the ball flying into the street, and just like, I don't know, not that drivers are paying attention anyway, so maybe it's going to be better.
Just as a quick aside, I am very interested in seeing hoverboard-oriented development just as a principle emerge. I do think that driverless cars will have a uniquely adept application in the Twin Cities, as we don't do things terribly linearly. Coming from a city like Seattle, which actually has some of the highest choke points for transit corridor, transit and arterial corridors in the nation, the Twin Cities just goes in a lot of different directions, and so creating true linear paths is really difficult. And It's one of the reasons why our ex-urban job centers are really hard to snag all on one transit line. So I personally think that that driverless cars could be particularly applicable in this metro area.
One more thought on driverless. With no disrespect to our wonderful bus drivers, that technology does present a huge opportunity for lowering transit operations costs. I mean, 35%, I think, of Metro Transit's budget is paying employees, which, you know, that is a loss, but at the same time, that money could be reinvested back into the system in a huge way.
I do think hoverboards could probably improve access to the skyways. Potential benefits.
Where's the PRT law?
Everyone has love for PRT.
I just read a City Data article about how PRT is on the down. Unfortunately, there aren't too many new systems in the last, I think, 10 years or so.
It's a loss.
West Virginia University.
So your Skyway system, I think this is from the perspective of somebody here who's not from the Twin Cities. Your Skyway system is impossible to navigate after 5 p.m. because buildings close and access disappears. How do you stop the perception that your city and downtown closes up at 5 p.m. with a Skyway system, much of which actually does?
Yep. Well, you know, I mean, the same thing happens in Chicago in the Loop. And if you walk around after business hours, the streets are pretty quiet, but that's the way you get around. So it's not as if the streets are closed. So that is a problem that we specialize in if you are trying to get around in the skyways. But just take the sidewalks. It's okay.
It is okay. So as the pro Skyway person, I would say that one of the only acceptable versions of a Skyway system going forward that is equitable and easy to access, I think it definitely should be managed under a central authority that would police it and make sure that it stays open the same way that a sidewalk would. But as far as right now, I mean, the Skyways are set to be open when it is realistic for them to be open. As of right now, I don't know of that many uses in the Skyways that cater to other than office workers, and they tend to go home right around 5. So I think that the real key to turning downtown into more 24-hour neighborhood is upping the residential density, which absolutely has been happening in what I would call downtown-adjacent neighborhoods over the last 10 or so years.
Okay. Anybody? Still on Skyways, would a better connection between Skyways and sidewalks allow for a viable compromise? Street activity, businesses for street storefronts, and I could wear skirts and heels year-round.
Well, you can wear skirts and heels year-round anyway. Now, you just can't get to and from the Skyway.
For the record, I bike in skirts and heels year-round.
I can wear skirts and heels year-round if I want.
Well, they do during the Warehouse District on club nights.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, right.
It's been proven.
Hennepin and First about 2 o'clock, plenty of skirts in January.
This is the modernist fantasy, though, that you can have weather, you can transcend weather, and then you can, like, have everything, and you know, Buckminster Fuller's dome and our Metrodome that we blew up, and, you know, get out of it, man. The weather is great. Penulosa's idea about, hey, let's not focus on those 2 weeks where it's below zero, or maybe 4 weeks. Let's not quibble over that. But it's beautiful right now, and no one should go in the Skyway unless it's below zero. That's my rule. You close them, only open them when it's below zero. Yeah.
See, I think making it easier to get to and from the Skyway level and street just complicates things at great expense, and it would be simpler if we could back away and eventually not have the system at all.
Just stop heating.
Stop heating.
Stop heating. In Los Angeles, bloggers and advocates are often at odds with transit operators and planners. Do you have recommendations for what we could do to foster collaboration between these groups? In less than 1 minute.
We get along great with planners, bloggers and planners love each other.
We do, yeah.
I think the question is about bloggers and planners and the transit operators and let me read that.
That's tough.
Yeah. And it's like the bus riders union, is that what you're talking about?
Bloggers and advocates, transit operators, and I guess it means transit planners. So like the transit agency and people who plan transit, and then the bloggers and advocates. So, you know, you all.
Well, you could have a debate like this at your next conference and invite, instead of just bloggers, invite transit and planners and bloggers.
We could really reinforce that. had the bad feelings by putting them on opposite sides.
All right. Will the Great Replacement song make any sense if we get rid of the Skyways?
Oh, we'll remember. I think those of us who experienced it will still get it. Even if future generations don't, that's their problem. But they'll be better off for not having the Skyways in the first place.
We also probably keep one around just for like a historical exhibit or something.
Yeah.
A little plaque.
The Historical Preservation Commission will ensure that.
That's a separate debate. What should we build on the Riverview corridor between Mall of America, Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and downtown St. Paul?
A lot of housing and mixed use stuff, you know.
I think this might be a transit question.
Oh, what kind of transit?
I'm just thinking.
Well, that's it. I think the streetcar, that's the proposal, is really interesting. And I think streetcars hopefully can be flexible enough to sort of serve as sort of a local connector, and then this street gets really sort of a lot less dense as you move towards the airport. And in theory, I would like to see a transit mode that could be kind of local, sort of walking generator towards the dense areas, and then speed through to the airport at the other end. Wouldn't that be a nice thing?
It's a tough one, because, I mean, there is bus service from downtown St. Paul to the airport now, right?
That's good bus service.
Okay, and I don't know how long it takes, but someone might. So the key is, I think you'd want something really fast, which would probably just be if you get to have 15-minute coach service nonstop from Union Depot to the airport, would probably make the most sense.
Yeah, there's
so that ignores West 7th, which should maybe just have a streetcar and down with it.
To me, there's certainly a question of how much is the mall and the airport a trip generator for downtown? And I'm sure downtown interests will tell you very large, and we do have bus service, but you know, there's other things at play too. The Ford site redevelopment, you know, huge potential job and housing location. There's a rail spur that goes up there. You know, what are the other needs that need to be addressed? And maybe it's a foregone conclusion that the airport will be served, but I don't know.
You know, I think I'd really like to ask the people along 7th what they might like, because I know that up here we've got 5 white millennial men and 1 white Xer woman, and I don't know that any of us lives in the community. So I would just like to highlight we may not be representative of what that community wants.
Please don't call me a millennial.
That was fantastic. Anybody else on that one?
I live kind of close.
Pretty close.
Okay. Raise your hand if you want to see a Railvolution debate again next year in Dallas. Okay, awesome. You're all a fantastic audience, and we're going to do the best thing possible at Railvolution. You have 5 minutes. Thanks for coming.
Fill out your evaluation.
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. Again, please consider donating to Streets.mn. You can do that from the front page. If you appreciate this podcast and would like to see it improved in the future, or if you appreciate the website and would like to see it continue in the future, we've got a bunch of other great podcasts coming up over the next few weeks, including conversation with Russ Stark about transit equity policy, conversation with Sharon Steitler, who's known as Bird Chick. She's a blogger and podcaster who does stuff about birds, and birds in cities is what we talked about. And then I just taped one the other day with Alex Cicchini, who is featured in this episode, about his recent study of looking at bus stop spacing frequencies in the Twin Cities and how that could be improved. It's a really interesting conversation that we had. So those are coming up in the next couple weeks. Thanks for listening, and keep supporting and for supporting this podcast. So long from Nicollet Mall in downtown Minneapolis.